Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 13th, the year 2000. Today's session is titled Stephen's Gate, Martyrdom and Witness. It's in the fireside room, and the presenters are Susan and Michael Thomas. So now let's go to the fireside room and listen in.
Begin rolling. I am Michael Thomas, and I serve as one of the ELCA pastors called by the Division for Global Mission in Jerusalem. We serve in the Old City at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer.
And we have here... I'm Susan Thomas, and we are co-pastors at that church, and we serve basically the English-speaking community in Jerusalem, but we work very closely with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan and Palestine as well, and so much of our attention certainly is involved with the Palestinian reality there in Jerusalem, and especially among the Palestinian Christians. We have a few things here. This is about our congregation and our ministry. This book we have ordered for the bookstore, and we need to encourage you to buy it.
I think there are only
two or three copies left. It's by a correspondent for the Boston Globe who did a series, who throughout the course of a year wrote about the diminishing Christian population in the Middle East, and specifically along the routes that Jesus traveled in his life. And it's a very well-written, engaging book, and we would encourage you.
And one of the aspects that makes it particularly fascinating is that he and his wife had their third child in Bethlehem, and his wife is Jewish. So that's a really powerful story to read in the book. Charlie sort of cut his journalist teeth in New York City, and he believes fervently that if you can cover New York City, if you can cover the urban beat, and if you can find out who the cops are and who the bad guys are, you can cover just about any hot place in the world. So I encourage you.
The Body and the Blood. The Body and the Blood.
Now let me ask, how many... Go ahead.
Can I just say...
Yeah.
This book, I'm a Palestinian Christian, is in the bookstore. Mm-hmm. It is by Mitri Raheb, who is the Lutheran pastor of Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. It was published, I believe, in 1994, so it's slightly dated, but virtually everything he says still applies. So it's really excellent as an introduction into the Christian community there. There's also a very good, inexpensive sheet that was written by Martin Bailey, who was part of our congregation for a while, indeed the president of our church council, but that was prior to our being there. And he has put together a very helpful description of words and phrases important to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and for understanding. And just reading through this is a very eye-opening and helpful way to begin to get at this information. We'll talk about some of the other things later.
Okay.
We have, throughout this week, been trying to go at this information using the theme of gates. The gates to the holy city, holy people, and holy land. And using the gates into the old city of Jerusalem as a means to do that. And tonight we are going to be speaking out of some of the things that occur to us when we look at Stephen's Gate. Now,
sometimes called Lion's Gate. Let me just first ask, how many of you came today? And so this would be, well, welcome. Let me mention that this is sort of the conclusion of the first week. And you're most welcome, and I hope it's meant to stand alone, so I hope that you will not feel lost. But we're going to begin again in a slightly different way, slightly different emphasis, on Monday. And so you're really welcome and invited to come back. And we're going to be doing a quick sort of crash course in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict on that evening.
Monday.
So we invite you to come back.
For the morning.
The morning session. Let me turn off the lights. We got all our technical problems down. We just got a computer, and that didn't work. So we're going to, I have to apologize because this is a different order than what it was on the computer, and I don't know why it isn't that same order. But I'm going to jump ahead and just see if I can quickly come to where we had intended to begin, and then we will, yeah, I think I can. Okay, well, this is close enough.
Okay.
I'm sorry. One of the themes that we've talked about are the gates of Jerusalem, perhaps the most prominent gate. On this map, we'll use Joe's wonderful low-tech pointer, is Damascus Gate, or the gate in Arabic, the gate of the column, which the Madaba map, which is a large mosaic about the size of this room, about two-thirds of it is still readable. It's still there. Other parts have been destroyed over the years. It was covered until the 19th century, and then revealed. And for years, people wondered why the Madaba, why the Damascus Gate had the name in Arabic of the column, Gate of the Column. And that's because, more clearly, of course, on the actual map, there is a column here, a Roman column. And this is from our rooftop where we live. It's with a telephoto, so it's actually not that close. But St. Stephen's Gate, or Lion's Gate, is accessed through going up between the cemetery portions on either side. These are cemeteries. This is a Christian cemetery here, a Greek Orthodox cemetery. These are Muslim cemeteries along the eastern section facade of the wall of Jerusalem, of the Old City. And you go up through here to Lion's Gate, or St. Stephen's Gate. And this is the gate here. And one of the reasons it's called Lion's, though it's still something of a mystery, is because there are relief sculptures of two lions or cougars of some sort. And this is on a Friday a couple of weeks ago, people coming, streaming in, Muslims streaming in to come into the Temple Mount, as Jews call that area, or Haram al-Sharif, as Muslims do, the noble sanctuary. And also we wanted to talk a little bit, how many have been to Jerusalem? Okay, a good portion of you have been there. And how many have either participated or have seen groups of Christian pilgrims processing up the Via Dolorosa, carrying, sometimes they're carrying crosses, singing. We do that on Good Friday, where we begin at 6 in the morning down here, and as merchants are opening up, they're still shuttered. Stores, we walk up, stopping at the traditional stations of the cross, but as Protestants, we can't enter into the Church of the Resurrection, Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where there are three stations of the cross, because we're not part of that league, so to speak. And so then we conclude at our church, Church of the Redeemer. This is a man, this is very common to see people carrying on these nicely made wagons carrying various goods. And this is Ecce Homo right here. And do you want to say something about that?
Well, I just wanted to invite, we thought we would invite you to consider as you follow part of the way on this historic, this traditional route of the way of the cross, but as you go to think of what it means to follow in the way of Jesus, and the fact that following in the way of Jesus literally here, you know, leads to the cross, and through that to the resurrection. So as we are speaking tonight, we want to bring into our memory and our understanding and our prayer those who have witnessed to the way of the cross, the way of Jesus, and have gotten into that way. The martyr that is commemorated at Stephen's Gate is Saint Stephen, the deacon, the first martyr Christian who lost his life for proclaiming for being a witness to who Jesus was. And so when we think about martyrdom in the context here of the conflict in Palestine and Israel, we have some pretty not so happy or not so blessed kinds of images, because we think of the martyrs who were the suicide bombers, or the use of that term for those who have taken that kind of an action as a witness to what they think is needed. We want to lift up tonight the use of the word martyr as witness, which is what it really is in Greek, a witnessing to who Jesus was and his way, and to try to think together and see some examples of ways that people have in the Holy Land tried to walk in a way that was nonviolent and non-retaliatory rather than violent and explosive, as we have seen in the martyrdom that is held up now in some of the Muslim population.
And I just want to point out that everywhere in the Old City of Jerusalem, you are followed with a video camera. We continue the walk, and I just want to point out that, as you can see, this is mid-morning on a Friday. There's really hardly anyone there making this particular walk, though. But as you turn the corner down here, suddenly Palestinian life comes into focus, and people are walking to worship now. Now, I'm not sure where these slides are going, because evidently there was a problem there. We've suddenly shifted now to the city of Hebron, and we want to talk about that because it's a Muslim Palestinian city with somewhere, I think, around 130,000 people. And in the sort of core part of that city, there are about 400 Jewish settlers that are protected by about 1,200 Israeli soldiers. In 1929, there was a terrible massacre of Jews in Hebron, and that is not forgotten. In fact, as you walk through Hebron, you'll see signs of the Jewish settlements. Remember 1929. Remember the massacre of 1929. It's important to note that Muslims also saved the lives of Jews on that terrible day. And then in 1972, 1942, maybe, several Jews came and stayed at a hotel and sort of had a rather extended stay until eventually they were able to form a settlement and receive Israeli military protection. We have entered Hebron on a day that the city is under curfew, but that inner core, now in fact, large parts of the city are under curfew at any given time. But on this day, this was taken in, I think, May or April of 2001. It's in that inner area of Hebron, the oldest area of Hebron that's under curfew. And it's quite an experience to be, I think in the section that we are visiting, there are about 15,000 Palestinians. Fred, do you happen to know a more accurate number? There are many, many Palestinians, many, many families, and it's quite striking to walk streets that are empty. And here, as we walk by, there's a man up on his balcony.
To be under curfew, for those of you who don't really know that term, it means that you're confined to your home. You can't go outside.
So then you, as a tourist, are free to go? Or
As an international. Now, it has changed since then. It depends whether the Israelis designate it also as a military closed zone. But at this point, internationals could move around. In fact, we had a little freer access than Jews would have, Israeli Jews, settlers. And so we're... Go ahead.
That previous picture was... There was an Israeli soldier?
No.
No, that was the man standing on his balcony looking out. That was as far as he could go out.
I see. Yeah.
And I want you to recall the picture I showed you just a minute ago of the busy market scene as people are going to worship in Jerusalem. And here you have market stalls down the street, and there's no one out. Okay, now I think I have to...
The reason that we've gone to Hebron, besides the fact that it's an example of one of the places where Palestinians have felt have really felt the pressure of Israeli control in their lives and have for a long time. The reason we've gone is because of the presence of some witnesses there, some Christian witnesses to nonviolent action. And this group is the Christian Peacemaker Team, which if you've been in our sessions this week, you've heard us refer to at various points. But they take as their whole slogan, their motto, getting in the way, meaning getting into the way of Jesus, walking in his way. And this little thing here has some sandals, stepping over barbed wire with the logo, getting in the way, Christian Peacemaker Teams. And they have, this is a group of people who have taken us, particularly out of some of the historic peace churches in the United States and North America, Mennonite brethren, friends, etc. But also they have Lutherans involved with them. Roman Catholics have been a very important presence. Methodists, Presbyterians. It's a wide range of people who have been involved in their witness. And they come, they train in nonviolent activity, and they have lived now in Hebron in a kind of revolving presence of anywhere from about 6 weeks to 3 months at a time. They will come and be a team of from 5 to 12 people living in an apartment with separate area for men and women. Some of them are quite young, others are into their 80s. And they come to be a nonviolent presence and to put themselves in the way of violence that may be about to happen in the city.
Let me just go ahead.
Was this the same group that was involved at Bethlehem when
they were involved in the Operation Baby Jesus?
I think, are you thinking of possibly the group that went into the Church of the Nativity?
Well, there was an organized, or what appeared to be in our news, an organized peace protest once the takeover had already happened, or the standoff, or whatever you want to talk about. They were people on the outside who came to protest. No,
there were several groups. There was an international group that actually got into the church. Whether they were helpful or not is another question. Then there was a group primarily of Christian peacemakers, but also involving a Roman Catholic priest and myself, and we participated in a project that we called Operation Baby Jesus, because Church of the Nativity is where the baby Jesus was born. That's the tradition. And we'll talk about that next week. Let me just mention, this is a view of...
Question, does you have a further question there?
But I was just wondering if it was the same group that was in Hamburg.
They were actively involved in planning actions that tried to enter and tried to break the barrier there, yes.
Okay.
But they weren't the people that ended up in the church.
Mm-hmm. Let me just mention that the Christian peacemakers can be found, if you visit Hebron, can be found in the chicken market. So just ask where the chicken market is, and you'll find the Christian Peacemaker apartment. And they live, they call themselves a team, but they live as a community, and that community life is really important. I think it's what sustains the Christian community life, and very much along the lines of the discussion in the Bible study today about the importance of community, that in a sense you need community in order to follow in the way or get in the way. Let me just tell you a very quick story about what getting in the way means. It can mean big things or relatively big things like this Operation Baby Jesus, but it can mean very small things. One time I was in Hebron, there was no curfew, and so an area like this would be just bustling with people, just packed with people. And all of a sudden there was a shooting somewhere, not close by, and the Israeli army immediately announced a curfew. They go through the streets and they say, you must be off the streets, this is a curfew, and so on. And so that means that everybody starts closing these metal shutter doors, trying to get out of there as quickly as possible, especially if you don't live in this particular area where the curfew is called. And you want to get out, you want to go through these cement blocks and get back to an area where you can have freedom of movement. And so we were escorting some journalists back from the Christian Peacemaker apartment to some services that they could take back, some shared taxis that they could take back to Jerusalem. When the shots were fired and the curfew was... put in place. And then you have all those people. I showed you that picture of the man pushing a boy pushing that cart. But you have all sorts of merchants that have these carts that sell everything from spices to something to eat to shoes. And we came across a couple of boys that were pushing carts trying to get back. They were trying to get out of the area that is controlled by the Israelis to the Palestinian-controlled area. And they were at a kind of blockage like this. And the Israeli soldiers said no. And these boys didn't live in the area that was being put under curfew. They wanted to get home. And so the Christian Peacemaker team inserted themselves between the soldiers and the boys. They took the carts. So what you have to imagine is a boy pushing a cart, trying to get this heavy cart out through this between these cement blocks. And then you have Israeli soldiers on the other side. And so the CPTers got on the side where the boy was and started pushing too and said, why, just let him go home. He just wants to go home. And if you have some soldiers that don't have experience in Hebron or don't have experience with CPT, they can be... they can be bullies. And what happened in this particular case was we asked to speak to the commanding officer, and they got him. They knew who CPT was, and they just essentially said, go on home. But that's sort of a small incident, but that's a daily incident. Another daily aspect of life is to escort Palestinian children to school, because the school, there's one school right across from some Jewish settlements. And so for a long time, Palestinians could not walk in front of the settlement because they were, this was before the current spate of suicide bombers, because they were afraid of some terrorist incident. So what you had to do was you had to walk up a hill about 40 steps, and then you walked along this hill, steep hillside for about 70 yards, and then you could come down. But you couldn't walk along the street. And so the CPTers, they could walk along the street, but they refused to do it. If they were really going to accompany the Palestinians, how could they walk on the sidewalk, on the street, when Palestinians couldn't? So they also walked up the street, but they would walk with the kids, Palestinians going to school, because sometimes Jewish kids would throw rocks at them and prevent them from going to school. And so this is a city under curfew. These are all internationals that are walking out right now.
The red cap and the armband are part of the...
Is Rich Meyer, who's a farmer in Indiana. His wife is a Mennonite minister. And he spends about 3 months a year in Hebron. And one of the great blessings for our congregation is that the Christian Peacemaker team worships with us every single Sunday unless they are engaged in an action. And sometimes that means traveling 2.5 hours to get to church.
So it should take about 40 minutes to get to church. But because of the barriers that have been set up to travel in the West Bank by the Israelis, it takes much longer.
And so really... It's a great blessing to have the Mennonite presence in our church, along with the presence of other church traditions that the CPTers incorporate, Roman Catholics, and Presbyterians, and Episcopalians, and Methodists, and yes, a few Lutherans. Leanne
Clausen,
who was a student of Herb Strickert's, is a very active team member. One person described her as a CPT natural. Let me just go back. I just want to point out one thing. We're in the marketplace now, and this market regularly comes under attack by Jewish settlers. They don't like the idea that the Palestinians are here in this marketplace, and right here is the Israeli military outpost. And the Christian Peacemaker team apartment is more or less over here.
Is there some significance with the armband?
Yes, it says Christian Peacemaker Team. It's a way of identifying them for both the settlers and Palestinians and military, so that they're readily identifiable. This is a park that was given by... There's another kind of observation group here, and that's composed mostly of Scandinavian policemen, and I think several other nationalities. Turkey, in fact, two of them were recently killed leaving Hebron, and it's still a little unclear actually who killed them. Perhaps it was Palestinians on a road just outside of Hebron. And the observation group it's under a separate, remember the name of the agreement? Okay. Let me just mention that they can only observe, and they cannot go to the media. All they can do is report to their home country what they see in clashes and conflict between Palestinians and Jewish settlers. They report those observations to their respective governments, and then their respective governments can then bring them to the attention.
And they also are not a policing force. They can't intervene in anything that they see.
So they can see Jewish settlers beating up Palestinian kids, and they cannot intervene. They can call for the Israeli military to come in and try to stop the conflict, but they cannot do anything themselves. Anyway, they gave this outdoor play equipment, and as you can see on this beautiful day, there's no one who's able to come out and play. And we're walking through the old merchant area. There are a couple of Israeli soldiers that are coming. They just spotted a couple of kids, and I have to say that they were quite reasonable. Perhaps maybe because of our presence, they were quite reasonable to the kids. And I just said, "Come on, get home." Yeah. Okay. And Susan mentioned barbed wire and the insignia of the Christian Peacemaker team, and there's a roll of barbed wire that's waiting to be unrolled somewhere to protect some settlement in Hebron, along with sand for sandbags.
And this, we'd just like to point out, what happened?
Okay, I was...
The woman on the left here, walking at the time, was the South African representative to the Palestinian Authority, and she earlier in the week we spoke in a panel at one of the forums here about the question of whether or not there were parallels between what's happening in Israel and Palestine to the apartheid that developed in South Africa. And I won't go into that discussion, but I will say that for her, the parallels were very clear. She felt there was very, and she was a very committed Christian as well, and was deeply interested in what the Christian Peacemaker team was able to do in this
world. And in fact, the Christian Peacemaker team really becomes the entree point for many such governmental and NGO representatives to come and see what is happening on the ground in Hebron. This is just outside the curfew area, so you can see a bustling city. These are the services or the shared taxis that I mentioned.
And I guess that's the end of that part. There were more pictures which we wanted to show you. Can somebody hit the lights over there? Just for a little while. Then we're going to be moving to, this is a multimedia presentation. We do so well with that one, we'll probably move on to something else that we can't handle. But anyway, we'll be doing some overheads in a little bit. But we wanted to point to the Christian Peacemaker team, obviously, as a witness for nonviolent action in this land. The local Christian churches have also been very much involved in this, including the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan and Palestine, the companion church of the ELCA. And we had pictures from New Year's Eve was it this year?
Yeah, December 31st, 2001.
Yes. So they had called, the heads of churches is representatives from 13 different churches who are historically there in Palestine. And they called for this peace march, which began in Bethlehem and then walked to the main checkpoint from Bethlehem into Jerusalem, with the hope that they would be let through by the Israeli soldiers at that checkpoint. They had come in by various other routes or individually, but this was a public march at that time. The whole area was not under closure in quite the same way as it has been recently. So it was easier to get in and out. But the point was to try to publicly break the barrier. And so they made this attempt. They were not allowed to go through the checkpoint, which in fact they expected would happen. But so we simply had prayers there at the checkpoint together ecumenically, which was also a very important witness.
And several Muslim prayers as well.
And some Muslim prayers as well. So Muslims had joined. There's a passage in this book that is I'd like to read about creative nonviolence. And it quotes Naeem Atik from the Sabeel Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center. And he says, most Christians, even if they are not committed to their faith, know that nonviolence is at the center of it. I believe that. The problem is, we don't have any clout. We don't even have the backing of the hierarchy of the church. That's one of the reasons why this march was important at that point. But we have to try. We have to try to be leaders for a movement that will be across cultural and national and religious divides. But I think it has to begin from the Palestinian Christian community. And we will be surprised to see how many Muslims are with us. And this, I think, is certainly the hope and the experience as well as these actions are taken. So there's that witness as well. As we think about following in Jesus' way. Another witness, really, which is not necessarily Christian, but is this international solidarity movement, which international people from throughout the world have come to try to be checkpoint watchers, to make sure that there is not too much brutality that happens at the checkpoints. To go to these places which are very in real conflict, and you heard about them at the Church of the Nativity. You heard about them entering Arafat's compound in Ramallah when that was a very amazing moment when they simply walked right through and got in. It was very inspiring, in fact, that they were able to break that barrier. A good example of nonviolent action working at that time. And also I want to let you know that there is now, through the World Council of Churches, an effort beginning. There was a pilot project during the spring of the year using some Danish church and Icelandic church people coming to be what is called ecumenical accompaniers. So it's the ecumenical accompaniment program in Palestine and Israel. And it is sponsored through the World Council of Churches, who has declared this as a priority item to begin. People are being trained in nonviolent techniques, and then they come for, it's modeled on the Christian Peacemaker Team idea that they will come and they will be able to go with people bringing medical supplies, and that their international status will somehow provide some possibility for things to actually, for the people to be protected enough to be able to get through. And that's not just Palestinians, but the world is going to pay attention to internationals. Well, this doesn't always work, but that's the idea. So
the Christian Peacemaker Team in Hebron are going to be the chief trainers for the accompaniers. And so perhaps there's some of you that might want to consider doing that, coming for 3 months and perhaps living in Augusta Victoria, the Lutheran World Federation Hospital in Jerusalem on the Mount of Olives.
And that will be the place where people will be staying most likely. Yeah. So it's nice to have that Lutheran center. I think we'll move to
the case study.
We want to talk to you about another case study of nonviolent action, and we'll be trying to use this overhead projector as we move into that. I don't know how many of you heard just about a year ago at the end of August. There was one of the first incursions.
Where is this? I'm going to light that up.
There it is. Excuse me. All right. One of the first incursions into Palestinian territory beyond Gaza, which had been, that had happened before. But one of the first incursions that got a lot of press was into Beit Jala. And I want to just start talking about this with a drawing that was done by a girl who was in our confirmation class at our congregation, but whose home, she was a Palestinian, her mother's American, her father is Palestinian, her grandfather started the Beit Jala, was one of the founding fathers of the Beit Jala congregation, the Lutheran congregation, which then that church and the orphanage that they run for 45 to 50 boys was invaded by Israeli military and used as a site for shooting. And perhaps some of you recall this happening about a year ago, and it received a great deal of press among Lutherans and the worldwide. It was a very effective time for nonviolent action. But anyway, I just wanted to point to this experience. I had actually given her, given the class that I was working with at that time, a little study sheet for them to, while the church service was going on, they were supposed to respond to what they heard in the sermon. And it happened to be a sermon on Revelation and getting the justice that was to come in the course of the book of Revelation. And then I said, invited them if they wanted to draw more or something about it, they could do it on the back sheet. Well, her sheet came back with this thing full of what her life was and what she understood.
So you have the Jerusalem Post reporting two Israelis killed today. Then she notes in the Arab press, 30 Arabs killed today. This is Beit Jala, a Christian town, and this is Gilo.
And then she said, it reminds me that I have to move away from my humble home, Palestine, Beit Jala. In fact, she and her family were moving in 3 weeks after her confirmation. And then she tells the story of a little girl who was killed.
I'll just point out one thing before.
Okay.
And she notes where the weapons come from.
Yeah, that's right. This girl was just in sixth grade at the time. She was an exceptionally mature girl, which is why she was in the confirmation class. But she certainly had a good understanding of what was happening to the children. And then she tells about this little girl who was killed at daycare. On that awful day, many more were killed. And then at the bottom it says, it also reminds me of all the bullets and tank shells and missiles that have hit my house. And the German doctor who was going on trying to save a person. That had happened back back in the fall of 2000. But he was from Beit Jala and she knew him as well.
And a Lutheran, right?
And he was a Lutheran, yeah. All right. This is just, you're not going to be able to make a lot of sense of this, but just to point out, this is where the church is down here, and it's just a kind of picture of entry.
What you have is a valley. See, Beit Jala and Gilo have the same continental structure. It's the same place. Gilo is an Israeli settlement that was built. It was the first settlement built after the 1967 war, and it's built across the valley right up here. So this is sort of the perimeter of Beit Jala here. It's on a hillside, rather steep hill descending here.
And
here is the Lutheran church.
Okay. And here you can see the Lutheran church in context with the Gilo colony. Now, it's interesting. Gilo is a settlement, and we think of it as a settlement. And if you were Israeli, you would be calling it a neighborhood. of Jerusalem. But Palestinians have been very clear about understanding what Israel has done in terms of activity as being colonization. And so they refer to Gilo as a colony. And you can see the church. The Gilo is back there on the hill, the church and the mosque of Beit Jala. So it's very, very close. They're very close to one another. This again shows you how close these are. These are the two cities that you've heard, or the two areas that you've heard a lot about shooting going back and forth.
So let me say what often happened. This is back in August of 2001. What would happen is that you have to understand something of the clan structure of Palestinians, but members of a particular clan who were active in armed resistance would drive up to the Christian neighborhood of Beit Jala. They would get out of their cars and they would shoot off a round of fire that would reach across but would do very little damage. I don't think anybody has been killed yet in Gilo. I know some
people. I think
people,
there may have been one person killed.
And several people wounded seriously. Mm-hmm. But what mostly happens is that, again, it's an act of terrorism. So what you have bullets coming in through your windows and you are terrorized. And the response, though, the various military pockets here in Gilo, is to shoot a tremendous barrage of tracer fire, machine gun fire, and tank shells across the valley, which is only several hundred yards.
So on this August day, this is the Lutheran Church of the Reformation in Beit Jala, and you see here the tank in front of it, and this whole area has been occupied.
There's an armored personnel carrier. It began with early in the morning, Bishop Muneeb Younan of the Palestinian Lutheran Church received a call from his pastor at this church and was told that Israelis had come during the night and occupied the church compound, which also houses, which is really significant, really central to the ministry, houses a home for boys. And so the Israelis came in the middle of the night. They demanded all the keys. They told the boys and their caregivers to go into one room. And then the Israeli soldiers went up into, this is called Abraham's house here, went up to the roof so that they could use that as an area to view what was going on and potentially fire from. And in fact, they did fire from there, which then attracted fire back. And that's a very important point, because the Israelis often will say that the Palestinians, and it's true sometimes, Palestinians will fire from populated civilian areas and thereby endanger the civilians if the Israelis fire back, or use the civilians in some sense as a kind of shield. And since everyone knew that this was a boys' home, the claim was made that that's what, in fact, the Israelis were doing by occupying the church.
This broken sign is significant only, I mean, it's not a large bit of damage, but symbolically, this is the sign for Abraham's house, which is a construction that has been under construction now for more than 3 years, as a dream of this congregation and its pastors to have an encounter place for Christians, Jews, and Muslims together in one place, and particularly for youth to come together and have this. So they have this. They've begun, and it's all close to completion. This wonderful conference and retreat center, and so this sign, which announces this effort at interfaith understanding, has just bit the dust here. And they're having a much different kind of encounter between between Christians, Muslims, and Jews that particular day. Okay, now, Bishop Munib Unan, that morning when this happened, began to alert everyone he could think of, all the Lutherans that he could think of in the world, and got them to go to their consulates in their various countries to really raise a hue and cry that this church, this sacred place, had been invaded by the Israelis. And this was very important because, you see, Israel said that this wasn't happening. And this was a key point, that Israel denied that they had gone in, had entered a sanctuary, a Christian sanctuary.
And here they really began to be extremely technical onto what constituted a church.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Israelis were trying to argue is that since they were not occupying the sanctuary where the pews are, they were not therefore occupying the church. And so what was all the fuss about?
So we, you know, wanted to make the point that the church's work and everything is larger than simply the praying. You know, it's the social work and this whole compound of the church. The other thing that the bishop began that morning was to gather together internationals and church people to go from Jerusalem to get into Beit Jala, to bring those children some food, which they didn't have on hand because they hadn't expected to have this happen, to be able to just go to see that they were okay. And so he negotiated along, Michael was involved with that very much that day, negotiated to get this group of church related people into Beit Jala. And when we came, we found we were having an encounter as just in terms of who those people were that we were encountering. We had half of the boys that were there were Muslim, half were Christian, those who are part of that school. We had Israeli Jewish soldiers who weren't there officially, but were being encountered nonetheless by those of us who came. We had other Israeli Jews and internationals who were part of this international solidarity movement, who had somehow also gotten into Beit Jala, even though it was completely closed off, and were very eager to be of assistance and to do what they could do to help to break this effort. And then we have the Christians who, you know, the pastor of the church, Jadala Shahada, and the boys. And we were able to get in, along with the Lutheran World Federation representative, Craig Kipples, and the Mennonite Central Committee head director, Alan F. Weaver, other German internationals, you see some of them there. And the Lutheran Church as a whole really came to a public statement here. And I would like to read something that Fred Stricker sent out shortly after this event about the effectiveness of this day. What happened, just to say, is that then that night we left with assurances that the soldiers would leave, who they finally admitted were there. We left with assurances that they would leave, and by 8:30 that night they had left. So the story of the incursion into Beit Jala, this is written by an Israeli columnist on September 4th. So it was about a week after, shortly after, after this had happened. The story of the incursion into Beit Jala didn't contribute to Israel's reputation for integrity in the eyes of foreign diplomats and foreign correspondents. The IDF spokesman repeatedly denied that troops entered the Lutheran church in the township. The foreign embassies were supposed to decide whom to believe, the Israeli spokesman or the churchmen and international media who insisted that with their own eyes they saw armed soldiers shooting from the church roof. Western diplomats say they are finding it increasingly difficult to believe Israel's versions. The Lutheran Church's membership in the U.S. had no doubts. They preferred the version proposed by the Lutheran bishop in Jerusalem, whose voice was heard coast to coast on the other side of the ocean. The echoing fury of the influential Lutheran community in America may have helped Ariel Sharon withdraw the forces from Beit Jala. Support from America's believers, Jews and non-Jews alike, is one of the most important assets he has nowadays. The last thing Sharon needs is for American Christians to stop believing that Sharon is really so good for the Christians. The Christian coalition in the U.S., which supports President Bush both politically and financially, is no less important to Sharon nowadays than the Jewish coalition in Israel. So we just wanted to really end with this example of some nonviolent action, some public understanding of what was actually happening, the kind of galvanizing of forces worldwide, to use the Lutheran network to make something happen, and that time where the issue was very clear. You know, they'd just gone into an orphanage, for heaven's sake, and a church. You know, this is not something that you can argue with very, it's not very subtle, you know, it's not very tricky. So it was a very clear issue that people were able to quickly understand and galvanize behind and be able to say no, no. And that no was heard, and the soldiers were withdrawn.
I think the analogy that some of us are making is that it's also just about as clear, even if the route to get to that clarity is more difficult with the situation in the present day in Israel and the West Bank, that there is clarity, that there is a great injustice that is being perpetrated upon the Palestinians, and that the world community, if it acts in a focused way, the way it did on August 28th, can change things for the better. We can change things for the better. Finally, I would just like to say, this is Pastor Jadala here, and I just want to tell you how moving it was, because he had not been able to get up to his church, and more importantly, to his children, to these boys, the whole day. When he came out of his house, he was shot at. He lives down below the church about a mile. And so when he came through the gate, we came as a delegation, we were carrying food. When he came through the gate and the children saw him and he saw the children, you just could feel the love that they had for each other and how important those children are in the ministry of this church. It's not a kind of addendum to their central mission. And so it was a really moving day, and we saw what could be done if we prayed and worked together.
It was one of the most moving things I've ever been part of. It was just a wonderful day.
And then in conclusion, we were to give essentially this kind of talk on September 11th in Geneva. And for obvious reasons, the talk was canceled.
So, I'm going to turn the lights on again, and I'm sorry, we're of course once again at the ending time.
So we would be glad to talk with people up until the time of Vespers if anyone would like to stay.